hot. Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1002, School Shootings and Fascist Groups, part 1, Purdy's Last Stand Redux. This is being recorded on March 27th of the year 2018. As I am speaking in late March of 2018, this past Saturday saw a march largely featuring young people in school against the unrestricted sales of firearms. And what we're going to do in this program is to take a look at the entire issue of school shootings, and we're going to look at it in a larger context. We're going to go back into the archives almost 30 years, although this program was actually recorded in the year 1992. It features two excerpts from January and October, respectively, from 1989. 29 years plus in one case, and not quite 29 years, for all intents and purposes, 30 years in the past. In Miscellaneous Archive Show M55, Purdy's Last Stand, an analysis of the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre or Shootings, I talked about Patrick Edward Purdy, the perpetrator of an early school shooting. There had been some before and many, many since that time. Purdy was in contact in some way with elements of the far right, what we call today the alt-right, the Aryan Nations. And he also had apparently been involved with the Moonies and may have been subject to mind control. There are aspects of the program you are about to listen to, and for the record, M55, the original Miscellaneous Archive Show, again, most of the material from which was recorded almost 30 years ago. The parts of that program I would have presented today in a more nuanced fashion, although I think it contains some very important truths. There is an apparent CIA connection to the gun control movement, that being a, quote, newly retired, unquote, ex-CIA officer named William O. Wells, who founded one and was instrumental in the founding of another handgun control organization, assisted in that regard by none other than former CIA Director William Colby, who headed up the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Aspects of the conspiratorial view presented in this archive show had actually become incorporated into elements of the fascist far right, or what is now euphemized journalistically as the, quote, alt-right, unquote. I think that is ironic for reasons I will explain more in our next program. In a lecture titled The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State, I talked about the documented and ongoing links between elements of the far right and the national security establishment, and ironically, the very martial law plans that elements of the far right inveigh against are going to be incorporated, or I think those groups themselves are going to help bring about in a manner that they do not necessarily realize. We'll talk more about that in our next program. Again, we're going to go back into the archives to January and October of 1989, listening to the story of Patrick Edward Purdy. There are many important things to understand about the analysis presented almost 30 years ago, although there are parts of this that I would have nuanced considerably more had I recorded it today. Note Purdy's anti-Asian xenophobia, his fear about immigrants, and the harm they are doing to Americans by taking away their jobs. This has a powerful resonance today, and indeed I think much of the Trumpian right, with the quote alt-right unquote, in this and other countries are motivated by a similar xenophobia that fed by economic deprivation, accelerated greatly by the financial collapse of 2008. Note Purdy's links with elements of the Aryan Nations and the fact that the Order, one of the founding members of the Order, was involved with a project not only to secure advanced weaponry for the Order, but also to acquire mind control techniques. Purdy himself also was involved with the Unification Church. He had gaps in his resume, despite the fact that 42 different law enforcement agencies had been keeping track of him. Most importantly, perhaps, note the impact on both students and parents of these school shootings. Psychologically, these are profound events that have the effect of terrorizing children. In, for the record, 1001, we took a look at, in large measure, at the interview I did with Frank Spiering, this from For the Record program number 7 back in 1996, and his discussion of how the polyclass kidnapping galvanized public sentiment. Not only were children terrorized of being kidnapped by malevolent strangers, it led to the passage of the Three Strikes Law here in California. Likewise, I think the impact of the school shootings on both parents and their children could not be exaggerated. So let's go back almost 30 years to January and October of 1989 in the archive.
This from the Moscow Idahonian of January 7th, 1986. This is by Mike Shepard of the Idahonian staff. It's headlined, "The Order, founding member of group sentenced in Moscow." That's Moscow, Idaho. A Hayden Lake man and founding member of the Order was sentenced in Moscow Monday to 5 years in federal prison for holding $100,000 in cash stolen by members of white supremacist groups. Daniel Ray Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, who pleaded guilty to charges of receiving and holding stolen money as part of a plea bargain agreement, was ordered to turn himself in to federal authorities on January 22nd by Judge Harold L. Ryan after a two-hour sentencing hearing in U.S. District Court. Skipping down in the story, a member of the Order, defense attorney of Mr. Bauer, a man named Hohen, said Hohen claimed that Bauer had been head of the Order's Reliance Project, which sought to obtain sophisticated weapons and research mind control techniques. Bauer, he told Ryan, should receive the maximum 10-year sentence. I should say Hohen was the prosecuting attorney here. Again, the Reliance Project that Bauer had been head of sought to obtain sophisticated weapons and to research mind control techniques. Well, there are abundant indications, and we took a look at this in Radio Free America's 5, 6, and 7, and also came back to it in connection with Jonestown in number 8, that elements of the U.S. national security establishment of the same basic political persuasion as the Aryan Nations have had mind control capabilities for a long time. There are indications that, in fact, the Aryan Nations or elements thereof have developed mind control capabilities. There's a group right here in the Bay Area, a Posse Comitatus spinoff, that has impressed me for some time as being able to place people under mind control. Some of the people that I have known that have become connected with that group appeared to me in no uncertain way to be under mind control. Again, this is an area that I think needs to be researched as to what extent certain elements of the Aryan Nations or elements thereof, certain pieces of that group may in fact have obtained at least crude capabilities to do the same kind of mind control that the national security establishment as a whole has been performing for years. And again, for those listeners to whom or for whom mind control sounds rather preposterous, Radio Free America shows 5, 6, and 7 deal exclusively with that subject. We also come back to it in a miscellaneous program about Jonestown, Dan White, and the Moscone Milk Killings, another program about Rajneesh Puram, a miscellaneous archive show, and again in the King Alfred Plan, we come back to it again. Radio Free America number 9, dealing with the Robert Kennedy assassination, also involves material concerning the federal government's mind control programs. One of the things we've spoken about in the past, too, is concerned something called the strategy of tension. This was a formalization of, or a restatement, really, I should say, by Italian terrorist and a P2 associate, Stefano Della Chiai, a person who not only worked with the Italian P2 Lodge, a crypto-fascist government that basically ran Italy for many years, but also a person who has worked in connection with the U.S. National Security Establishment as well. Della Chiai is an Italian fascist who called his strategy of setting off bombings and terrorist incidents in order to blame them on the left and shift the electorate to the right, he called that the strategy of tension. The Nazis in the Third Reich referred to a similar strategy as Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness. And we're going to take a look at an incident which took place this past week in Stockton, California, in which a lone nut, quote-unquote, one of the many that have cropped up in the United States over the last quarter of a century, suddenly went berserk and took a machine gun, an AK-47, a Soviet assault rifle, which he was able to obtain despite not apparently having enough money. He somehow converted it to fully automatic and showed up in Stockton and sprayed a bunch of school children, most of them Asians, all of the fatalities were Asians, and thereby dominated the headlines for several days. One of the most important and up to this point tragically overlooked pieces of political research in the United States was done by the late Mae Russell, whose work was aired for many, many years here on KFJC. In a very, very important article that she wrote in 1974 for The Realist magazine, called the SLA is the CIA, Mae Russell revealed that many of what she called the California violences, the seeming ravages of, seemingly unconnected lone nuts and or political extremists in California, such as the Zodiac Killer, the Zebra Killer, the Manson Family, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and other activities, Mae was able to demonstrate that, in fact, many of those incidents were being set up by local police departments working in conjunction with the Reagan administration in California and with elements of the CIA, FBI, and military as well. And Mae's article, for example, on the Symbionese Liberation Army demonstrated rather conclusively that the Symbionese Liberation Army had been set up by the government as a provocateur operation, as a way of terrifying people. Activities of that type convince people that the general social environment is a dangerous one, that they need more police, stronger police tactics, perhaps bigger prisons, fewer civil liberties, and that things like that are needed, perhaps the suspension altogether of civil liberties, a la Rex 84. People are convinced that they need a strong man. We need somebody to set things right. This was the call that the German people gave for their Führer, Adolf Hitler. And there are indications that if this kind of thing continues, the American people may very well be moved in a similar direction. In particular, a lot of the scenarios that I discuss on this program, the eventual institution of formal, overt German-style fascism, I think are going to take place after an economic collapse. Certainly the debt situation being what it is at this point, I think the possibilities of a total depression cannot be dismissed, and in fact many economic observers are worried about just exactly that sort of thing. In light of the massive debt that the United States is now enduring in all respects, certainly I think such a possibility has to be viewed as virtually inevitable at some point. It is after the coming of a depression and the massive social dislocation that will result from such a depression that many of the scenarios that I envision will take place, in my opinion. So if some of this seems a bit remote, bear in mind, I think it will take the impoverishment of a large segment of the American middle class and working class to accomplish this. I'm afraid that just such an impoverishment is on the way. Again, I think we should perhaps step back and take a look at the recent incident in Stockton, California, in light of Mae Russell's landmark and tragically overlooked research concerning the California violences and their deliberate provocation by the authorities in what could be viewed as a California application of what Stefano Della Chiai referred to as the strategy of tension, what the Nazis referred to as Schrecklichkeit, a very subtle and, well, subtle not in terms of the grotesqueness of the actions, but perhaps subtle in terms of the political overtones, or at least the understanding of the political overtones, yet very insidious form of terrorism. There are indications, perhaps, that Mr. Purdy, who shot up these school children in Stockton, may have had a far lot more going for him than the press let on, at least initially. Bearing in mind the article that I read at the top of the broadcast, the James Michener column, in which he talked about the invasion of the United States by foreign capital, in particular Asian and German capital. And again, I talked about the xenophobia that many Americans are beginning to experience as a result of the massive influx of Asian populations, the dislocations, the social dislocations that are taking place in the United States as a result. And I cautioned that that type of xenophobia and that dislocation will serve as very effective recruiting tools by the Aryan nations and elements of a similar orientation. They will be able to point to, and quite correctly, to the fact that Asians and others are, in fact, taking jobs that would otherwise have gone to Americans. They will then use that in a deliberately racist and reactionary way to foment recruitment into their own ranks. Interesting article as we now begin to examine the shooting in Stockton this past week, from an article by Linda Goldston, Lisa Lappin, and Pamela Kramer of the San Jose Mercury, Dateline Stockton, headlined, "Toy Soldiers, a Puzzling Clue to Drifters' Twisted Motives." There's an interesting reflection here on Patrick Edward Purdy. He also was called Mr. West at some point. He worked under that alias, Eddie P. West. Of his views and what perhaps may have led him to pull the trigger on those poor children, a year ago, Purdy, calling himself Eddie P. West, worked at a small Stockton machine shop called New Mary Tech. There, Steve Sloan, a night shift supervisor, remembered a disconcerting conversation during one of the few casual talks they ever had. Quote, he said, "Our country's so free that we allow other people to come over here, and that's how we'll be able to be overtaken from the inside. I just kind of shrugged it off like it was nothing," unquote. Sloan said Purdy talked strangely about the United States being able to, quote, "let people in and give them houses," unquote, and allowing their entire families to come over. When he was talking about that, he said, you could see how it frustrated him. More on Mr. Purdy's xenophobic and racist views of Asian immigration. And again, another article about Edward Purdy, Purdy, I think of Purdy and West. His first names have always lived. Patrick Edward Purdy, okay, I always confuse the Edward with Eddie West. An article from the evening edition of the San Jose Mercury from Thursday, January 19th of 1989, an article by Lisa Lappin on the front page of the evening edition of the Mercury for that day. It's Dateline Stockton, and headline, "Stockton Killer Had a Hatred, Quote, for Everybody," unquote. And skipping down in the article, it's continued on the back page, more about the anti-Asian racism of Mr. Purdy. Jim Mickelson, M-I-C-K-E-L-S-E-N, a 21-year-old welder who came to know Purdy last year when the men worked together for a month, had heard him complain about the high percentage of Southeast Asian refugees in industrial arts courses he was taking at San Joaquin Delta College. He didn't like the idea of jobs being taken away, Mickelson said, and he didn't like having to compete with them in classes, unquote. A mental health report prepared on Purdy after an April 1987 arrest in El Dorado County called him, quote, a danger to his health and others, unquote, the Sacramento Bee said today. The report, which also described Purdy as suffering from mild mental retardation, unquote, and mixed substance abuse, unquote, was prepared after a sheriff's officer found Purdy and his half-brother, Albert Goulart Jr., blasting trees near Lake Tahoe with a 9mm Browning semi-automatic pistol. Purdy, who was intoxicated, was arrested. In jail, he removed his shirt, ripped it up, and made a rope from it. He was attempting to hang himself when he was discovered, the Bee reported, and he also tried to cut his wrists. During his arrest, the Bee said, he had told the officer it was his, quote, duty to help the suppressed and to overthrow the suppressor, according to the arrest report. He also said he was, quote, no longer going to be pushed around, unquote, and kicked out the rear window of the officer's car, the Bee reported. He talked about how commies, unquote, were extorting money from him, and officials found a book on the Aryan Nation in his possession. It was not known whether Purdy belonged to a white supremacy group, but police said an ammunition clip he carried Tuesday had the initials SSA written on it. An expert on white supremacy groups said Wednesday that the initials are commonly used in such groups' literature and stand for SS Action Group after the Nazi Special Police. His weapons also bore other supremacist phrases and slogans of Middle Eastern terrorism groups, and police said he might have had, quote, delusions of grandeur, unquote, about terrorism. Skipping down on the story, Goulart said the father was the root... Goulart, that's his stepfather, Goulart said the father was the root of young Purdy's distrust of foreigners and obsession with Middle Eastern radical groups. His father, I guess, must have given him that, he said. His father was a little bit in the mental stage himself. After Purdy was forced to leave home, he moved to San Francisco. He would vanish for months at a time, living off the land, traveling, working odd jobs, said Aunt Julie Michael, 45, of Sandy, Oregon. For a time, he lived on the banks of a California river because he had no money. But he was trying to better himself, and he attended welding courses at San Joaquin Delta College, she said. He never stayed in one place for long, Michael told the Bee. He was a loner. He would travel all over the United States, work here and there, from the time he was 14 years old. Well, there are a number of things to take note of in this article. Again, first of all, about the possible Aryan Nations connection here. Purdy did have an Aryan Nations book in his possession, and obviously was displaying neo-Nazi slogans, among others, in his various accoutrements, his rifle and some clothing that he had along with him. An article from the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, January 18th, this by Paul Avery, Ken O'Toole, and Craig Marine of the Examiner staff, also Dateline Stockton and headlined, Killing Was Businesslike, contains some details concerning just the kinds of markings that Purdy had on his rifle and clothing and so forth. According to a police officer at the scene of the shootings, Purdy had the letters PLO written on the pocket flap of his shirt and the word Satan on its back. Purdy's rifle, purchased in the Portland, Oregon suburb of Sandy while he was visiting relatives last fall, also had Hezbollah written upon it. The initials SSA were written on the ammunition clip, police said. Hezbollah is a fundamentalist Shiite Muslim faction in Lebanon, believed to have played a role in the kidnappings of some of the foreign hostages in the Middle East. Police estimated Purdy fired between 60 and 100 rounds from the high-powered rifle, and perhaps from at least one of the two 9mm semi-automatic pistols he carried with him to the school, police said. Victory was scrawled on the handle of one of those pistols. Skipping down, Sandy, Oregon Police Chief Fred Punzel said the rifle had been purchased from the Sandy Trading Post last August 3rd. Punzel said Purdy had lived with an aunt and uncle in Sandy for several months until October. He said the aunt, Julie Michael, told me he was a loner and as a child he was an alcoholic, unquote. He said Purdy also had apparently been living in Texas, Memphis, Tennessee, and Connecticut since leaving Oregon. Punzel said Purdy had no police record in Oregon and thus was qualified to purchase the AK-47. A couple of the things to note, in addition to the Middle Eastern slogans, the neo-Nazi slogans, a couple of the things to note about Purdy. One was the fact that he appeared to do a lot of traveling with no apparent resources. He was so strapped for money that at times he had to write relatives for money. He was observed stealing waitresses' tips and sleeping on the street in Connecticut. He apparently, though, was able to get around. That's one thing to take a look at here. Also, the amount of money he had for firearms is worth noting. He had to pay hundreds of dollars for this AK-47. He also had to shell out quite a bit for the various Browning automatic pistols. At the time, his disability benefits had been cut back tremendously. And again, he was always short on money and was not observed to be a man of any considerable means. Yet he did appear to do a lot of traveling and was able to arm himself to a considerable extent. One of the questions this raises is, where was he getting his support? One of the enduring patterns of the operations of the U.S. National Security Establishment in this country for the last quarter of a century has been the deliberate creation and manipulation of what are wrongly represented in the news media as lone nuts. This is a long, very tragic tradition in which such obvious U.S. intelligence agents as Lee Harvey Oswald, people like Saran Saran, James Earl Ray, and others are being portrayed as lone nuts and the lone killers of people like the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. Also, many of the people that have supposedly just flipped their wig for no reason and started shooting up one place or another, or one individual or another, frequently turn out to be not lone nuts at all, but rather deliberate tools used by the U.S. National Security Establishment. Again, the tremendous work that Mae Brussel did concerning the California violences, as she called them, and that work, by the way, can be found in considerable measure on Radio Free America number 23, our program dealing with terrorism in California under Ronald Reagan. In that landmark work, Mae was able to uncover the fact that a lot of these supposed nuts, the lone nuts who committed our assassinations, the lone nuts who committed many of these terrorist incidents in California, these serial killers are not really screwballs at all, but tragic human guinea pigs who have been manufactured in the American mental health and prison systems with the collaboration between local law enforcement authorities and the U.S. National Security Establishment. Two of the characteristics of these intelligence lone nuts, as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 5, 6, and 7, among others, are the fact that they're able to get around with no apparent means of support, they're able to be protected from law enforcement authorities, and they're able to get weapons. You know, guns are not that cheap, particularly an automatic rifle, and there are considerable discrepancies in their resumes. This is what we see with regard to Edward Purdy, or Patrick Edward Purdy, and again, we cannot draw a conclusion from it, but rather, I think it should cause us to ask some questions. We need, I think, to fill in more information about Purdy's background. The fact that Purdy sported both neo-Nazi and Middle Eastern terrorist slogans is interesting in light of the work that we've done on the intersection between Nazism and Middle Eastern terrorism. That intersection goes back to the Second World War and the efforts successful on the part of elements of the Third Reich in forming an alliance with Palestinian separatists at that time working against the British and later, of course, working against the Israelis after that. We took a look at the geniture of Middle Eastern terrorism under a joint CIA-Skorzeny-Allen Dulles mission to the Middle East. The Egyptian and Libyan secret services owe their origin to that Nazi CIA group. We also took a look at the fact that the CIA has actively supported Middle Eastern terrorism, courtesy in considerable measure of the Triple Wilson operation. Radio Free America shows 4 and 22 talk about that, as does the series dealing with the shooting of the Pope. Radio Free America shows 17 through number 22. We've also taken a look at the fascist third position in which, to this day, American neo-Nazis, some of them, and worldwide neo-Nazis, some of them with links going back to people like Haji Amin al-Husseini, people like François Jeannot, the fellow who financed Jacques Vergès' defense of Klaus Barbie. There are still very profound connections between neo-Nazism and third position fascism in general and Middle Eastern terrorism. Third position fascism is a new fascist position which seeks to win over more progressive elements by incorporating certain apparent aspects of the progressive political agenda, such as pro-ecology and anti-Soviet and American imperialism stands. Actually, it appears that the fascist third position is very similar to the Gregor Strasser wing of the Nazi Party, which deliberately sought to attract progressive elements and to use them for their own purposes. Again, I think the possibility of mind control here is something that should be considered, and the possibility that perhaps there is a whole lot more here to Edward Purdy than just a lone nut. There are indications that he is one of the long pattern of California violences. Again, the fact that he apparently did have some interest in neo-Nazi literature, the fact that he was able to get around as much as he did is interesting to me. Also, I wonder where he got his AK-47, the rifle that he obtained, where he got it converted to fully automatic. Because apparently you have to either be pretty expert in firearms, or else you have to know somebody that knows how to convert it. He bought the weapon semi-automatic. Somewhere it was converted to fully automatic. And conversion kits, as they're called, are a major item in the paramilitary right-wing arsenal, I guess you could say. Now, also, another interesting detail about the seemingly crazy symbology that he surrounded himself with, although as we see, there may be a whole lot more of a method to this particular madness than many of the media voices have reported. Some of the Middle Eastern terrorist and neo-Nazi slogans that he sported make a lot more sense than I think some people may be willing to admit. Interesting to me, too, he was sporting the Zodiac Killer symbol, among others, from the Chronicle of the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, January 19th of 1989, an article by Michael Taylor and Alan Stone of the Chronicle, Dateline Stockton, headlined, School Killer's Last Days. Interesting little detail here. about some of the scrawlings that Patrick Edward Purdy had. Near the words V for victory written in black felt pen was a drawing of a small child, of a smiling child. Surrounding the child were faces of snarling men with spiky hair. The cloth also bore several five-painted stars, a six-pointed star, sometimes used as a satanic symbol, and a circle divided by a cross, reminiscent of the trademark favored by the serial killer who called himself Zodiac. And again, I wonder if what we're looking at here with Edward Patrick Purdy is another in the long, long, tragic line of California violences. Supposed random nuts who, in fact, are being generated specifically for our consumption on our TV screens. A little bit of home-style do-it-yourself Schleschlichkeit here. You know, you can sit back and watch the world go to hell on your evening TV screen while you're eating dinner. Again, I'm not stating this in a declarative sense. This is in an interrogatory sense. I'm not saying this is. I'm asking, is it? Because I see indications that it may be. And again, the entire broadcast tonight, or most aspects of it, goes into the category of food for thought and grounds for further research. My fear is that what we may be looking at with many of these incidents is a deliberate attempt at driving the American people over the line to the point where they will accept something like the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan and take it in stride. One of the things that's worth noting is that there have been a lot of school shootings in recent years. There have been a lot of incidents of lone nuts, quote-unquote, showing up at schoolyards and just seemingly blazing away at school children for no apparent reason. And one of the things that I think should be borne in mind here is an incident that took place in the Third Reich. And that's something we've discussed in the past, and it was the Fritz Haarmann incident. In the program that we did on the Pink Triangle, dealing with gay rights, reproductive rights in the Third Reich, we talked about the Fritz Haarmann incident. By the way, that program was based in considerable measure on the book, The Pink Triangle, by Richard Plant, that many of you can find. Now, in the book, The Pink Triangle, and in our program by the same name, we took a look at the Fritz Haarmann case. Fritz Haarmann was a supposed lone nut, a fellow in Hanover, Germany in 1923, who committed a series of over 100 brutal killings in which young men and boys were waylaid, were then sexually assaulted. Fritz Haarmann was a homosexual. They were then murdered and their bodies butchered and sold as horse meat on the open market. Fritz Haarmann dispatched more than 100 young men and boys. The total number of killings he was convicted of was something like 115. And the case sensationalized Weimar Germany. It became a major media item for a long time and served as a major device of public terror. All over Germany, children were citing the rhyme, "Be still and quiet, little mouse. Fritz is coming to your house. With his blade so sharp and neat, he'll make you into red chopped meat." And the Fritz Haarmann case became a major element of, I guess you could almost say, pop culture in Weimar Germany, and served to terrorize the public to an enormous extent. And again, I think there are some analogies to be made between the effect of the Fritz Haarmann case and the effect of these California violences, in particular the school shootings that we're going to take a look at here, upon the American public. It eventually turned out that Fritz Haarmann was no lone nut at all. On the contrary, he was a police informer for the Hanover Police Department and apparently, according to information developed, ran his own informant network, which he represented as being a detective agency. Efforts to expose the connections between Fritz Haarmann and the Hanover Police Department by the German Communist Party in Hanover were sharply rebuffed by the chief of police of Hanover, who, interestingly enough, was a fellow named Gustav Noske, as we looked at in a book called Paramilitary Politics in Weimar Germany by James Diehl, D-I-E-H-L. Gustav Noske was not only the chief of police of Hanover, but formerly had been the defense minister for the Weimar Republic, who set up the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr units, which essentially dispatched not only the revolutionaries in Weimar Germany, the communist revolutionaries, but went on to dispatch all socialist and democratic elements in Weimar Germany, thereby paving the way for Hitler's rise to power with a program of assassinations. Again, the Freikorps, the Ein Wohnerwehren, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, the three main elements put together by Gustav Noske and President Ebert initially to combat the German Revolution, those same elements then remained intact in spite of the order to disband, And as the Black Reichswehr, the Freikorps, they dispatched the all democratic elements in Weimar Germany. In considerable measure, the Nazi Party then grew out of these very same underground military units that in Radio Free America shows 10, 11, 12, and 13 we compared with the Aryan nations, or rather we compared the Aryan nations with the Freikorps and asked whether this represented, in effect, an American Freikorps. And I think the effect, the psychological effect on the American public of these seemingly random violences, and some of them undoubtedly are random violences. You know, there are, with the growing lack of mental facilities for people who are disturbed on the kinds of cutbacks we saw first under Reagan in California, now in the United States as a whole when Reagan became president, with the continued pouring of violence and glorification of violence into this society by the media, certainly we're going to see our share of people just flipping their lid and blazing away at whatever. And those incidents, too, will serve to reinforce the notion that, well, the whole country is going crazy and we need a strong man to do something and set the situation right. But I think some of these school shootings, at least, I think need to be looked at greater length and need to be examined in terms of deliberate provocation, perhaps in the same light as the Fritz Haarmann case in Weimar, Germany, as in the same light as the strategy of tension of Stefano Della Chiaia. In the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, January 18th of 1989, there was a very important article by David E. Early of the Mercury News staff writer, Early as in Early and Late, E-A-R-L-Y. This article is an interview, in considerable measure, with a psychologist who studied one of these school shootings. This article is headlined, "Community Now Must Contend with Shooting's Emotional Fallout." Skipping down in the article, talking here about school psychologist who is named Elan or Ellen Adler, A-D-L-E-R. Adler says here, in skipping down on the article, of the school shootings, "It shakes the whole community," says Adler, 38, who was assigned to the Winnetka school case and is anxious to clear up the notion that the incident will affect only those connected to the schools. Quote, "A shooting at a school is a violation of the entire community," says Adler. "A shooting at a school is a violation of the entire community. Everyone will be struck with the feeling that there really is no safety, and that triggers a deep and disturbing rage." "That's a big problem," says Adler, "because while you want to reassure the kids that the world is a safe place to be, as a parent, you don't really feel that way at all," unquote. And when parents feel they can't protect their own children, the resulting sense of helplessness is almost overwhelming. Skipping down in the story, "Aside from fear for their children, parents will have their own set of emotions to bring under control. They will feel angry and betrayed," says Adler. "They moved to a safe community so their kids could grow up healthy, and now, in one day, their children have lost their sense of innocence and their community has changed forever. That feeling is the most negative and pervasive thing you can imagine. The most difficult part of the healing process may be the very fact that school shootings continue to happen." Adler says counseling in Winnetka focused on telling kids that what Lori Dan did was a fluke, an isolated incident, and that they should not be ever afraid of going to school. "But here we are again," says Adler sadly. "We are supposed to assure our children that there is some security in going to school, but to tell you the truth, it's getting harder and harder to do that." And again, I think some of these sentences are worth rereading here. "It shakes the whole community," says Adler. "A shooting at a school is a violation of the entire community. Everyone will be struck with the feeling that there really is no safety, and that triggers a deep and disturbing rage." "That's a big problem," says Adler, "because while you want to reassure kids that the world is a safe place to be as a parent, you don't really feel that way at all. And when parents feel they can't protect their own children, the resulting sense of helplessness is almost overwhelming." And skipping down, about the parents, "They will feel angry and betrayed," says Adler. "They moved to a safe community so their kids could grow up healthy, and now, in one day, their children have lost their sense of innocence and their community has changed forever. That feeling is the most negative and pervasive thing you can imagine," unquote. And again, I think one of the things we need to evaluate as we see the Aryan Nations connections of Edward Patrick Purdy, as we observe the apparent discrepancies in what he had and what he was able to do, as we observe A person who was so economically beset that he had to steal waitresses' tips, and yet he was able to shell out hundreds of dollars for an assault rifle, a Soviet assault rifle, too, which I think, in the minds of much of the general public, you know, the use of a Soviet weapon, the Middle Eastern terrorist slogans, would perhaps unconsciously at least, but I think to a certain extent serve to pigeonhole this incident as if not apolitical, as a sort of a left-wing incident. I think that the Aryan Nations connections here would tend to be clouded in people's minds by the Soviet rifle and the Middle Eastern terrorist slogans. Certainly, at least in this country, Middle Eastern terrorism is represented as being the product of Soviet activity. As we've looked at, there are indications, in fact, that the truth is quite the opposite. Of the wave of school shootings that has afflicted the United States over the past several years, in that same edition of the San Jose Mercury, Wednesday, January 18th of 1989, there is a discussion of some of these school shootings. I'm not going to go into all of them, but a couple of them are worth noting. October 3rd of 1988, a gunman in a camouflage outfit opened fire at a third-grade gym class on the playground at Mascot Elementary School in Mascot, Florida, wounding a 9-year-old girl before fleeing. A few days before that, September 26th of 1988, an attacker who said he was copying a rampage by a woman in Winnetka, Illinois, opened fire in a crowded cafeteria and in a third-grade classroom at Oakland Elementary School in Greenwood, South Carolina. 2 8-year-old girls died, one at the scene and the other 3 days later, and 7 students and 2 teachers were injured. May 20th of 1988, 30-year-old Lori Dan entered Hubbard Woods Elementary School in Winnetka, Illinois, and killed an 8-year-old boy and wounded 5 other children before heading to a nearby house where she shot a college student before turning the gun on herself. Police discovered that Dan also mailed packages of poisoned food before her shooting spree. Skipping down, May 16th of 1986, a heavily armed couple with a bomb took 150 students and adults hostage at an elementary school in Cokeville, Wyoming. They demanded $300 million ransom but were killed when the bomb exploded accidentally and the man shot himself. One teacher was shot in the back when he tried to flee, and 74 people suffered second-degree burns in the blast. And skipping down again, we talked about this last incident, by the way, and one of the things that this article does not mention is that the people who were going to blow up that school also had connections to the Aryan Nations and the paramilitary right. Again, we talked about that incident when it happened here on One Step Beyond. And another one of these incidents that we talked about on One Step Beyond, February 24th, 1984, an 11-year-old girl and an adult passerby died and 11 others were injured during a sniper attack at the 49th Street Elementary School in Los Angeles. Police later said that Tyrone Mitchell, who committed suicide after his home near the school was surrounded, had lost most of his immediate family in the Jonestown mass murder-suicide in Guyana in 1978. Well, again, of all of the California violences, Jonestown was the most violent, and as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 6, 7, and 8, and in the aforementioned miscellaneous tape on Dan White in Jonestown, all indications are that Jonestown was in fact an operation of the U.S. National Security Establishment. So it's interesting to see another one of these California lone nuts, another one of these screwballs who snaps his wig, flips his wig, being linked here with the whole Jonestown situation. And again, I think some of the right-wing and paramilitary right connections to some of these people, the May 16th, 86 bombing in Wyoming was definitely connected with Aryan Nations. I think when these people show up in fatigues, whether they're shooting up a school or like James Huberty, who shot up a McDonald's and killed a great many Latin Mexicans and Mexican-Americans the day that Walter Mondale received his nomination, I think we need to examine the backgrounds of some of these people and see whether perhaps there's more to it than just a bunch of lone nuts. I think we need to find out whether, as I suspect, some of them at least, if not all of them, are in fact being used as patsies, as guinea pigs and fall guys by reactionary and explicitly fascist elements of the national security establishment. And again, for people to whom that sounds preposterous, some of the revelations in our mind control series, some of the revelations in the Iran-Contra scandal in which these very same Klan, neo-Nazi, and survivalist elements were going to be used by Oliver North's Security Council as deputies, as federal deputies, in the Rex 84 contingency plan to round up people they perceived to be troublemakers. And that once again from One Step Beyond of January 22nd, 1989, in addition to outraging the public and generating sympathy for greater police powers, more prisons, reduced civil liberties, I suspect that some of these provocations, or these mind-control nuts, if in fact that's what they are, and I am convinced that that's what Purdy was, I also am convinced that's what George Henard was down in Texas. Some of them, as I said, may be naturals. But among the things that the Stockton schoolyard killings did, Purdy's last stand, was to generate sympathy for the first substantive gun control legislation that was ever passed in California. As I've said before, when the national security establishment decides to move in any one direction, they do so when to move in that direction will scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. And it is my fear that perhaps, in addition to outraging the public and generating basically Fritz Haarmann-type incidents, that some of these mass shootings, and I believe the Killeen, Texas massacre, which took place as Congress was considering a severe gun control piece of gun control legislation as part of George Bush's anti-crime package, and the Purdy situation were definitely provocations, and I suspect both of them are mind-control jobs. Oh, I'm personally convinced they're mind-control jobs. It's interesting to note that Henard, who we're not going to discuss here, had been in contact with a, quote, mysterious blonde woman, unquote, who was never properly identified. That's one area of investigation that I think needs to be pursued in this regard. In just a minute, we're going to listen to a segment from One Step Beyond, exactly 9 months after that first segment from January 22, 1989, we're going to listen to a segment from October 22, 1989, in which information came but was brought out. I brought out information from a Stockton Record article from 10/7/89 that Patrick Edward Purdy, in addition to his apparent contacts with elements of Aryan nations, had also been in the Moonies. People don't think of these as political events, and yet the Cleveland schoolyard massacre, and again, I'm skipping around a bit because the full discussion of the Cleveland schoolyard massacre, the Cleveland Elementary School shooting, would be, again, too broad for the purposes of the discussion here, but it not only represented an excuse to begin limiting the public's access to firearms. This, I feel, is part of a program, a preordained program of political reaction, but it also serves to terrorize the living hell out of people. People are much more willing to see their rights compromised. They're willing to see the Bill of Rights abrogated. They're willing to see greater and greater powers by the national security establishment and the police forces. They will accept a police state in order to preclude the possibility of their children getting shot up at school by these nuts who are running around. Again, it's not thought of as a political event. It is profoundly political, and this is why, in my opinion, and obviously this builds on May's work, some of these lone nuts, and I'm not suggesting all of them by any means, are hypno-programmed, but a lot of them appear to be. And there are continuing indications that this may have been the case with Patrick Edward Purdy. Bear in mind also that a teacher from the Cleveland Elementary School who is going to testify at a hearing with regard to the possibility of banning assault rifles received a threatening letter with the swastika letterhead. Whether there's any connection at all between that and the Aryan Nations literature and the Nazi orientation, the Aryan Nations graffiti sported by Patrick Edward Purdy, remains to be seen. But again, it was my scenario, and again, we don't know for sure, but it is my hypothesis that Purdy was one of these mind-control zombies and that this event was another one of the California violences. Information pointing in that direction, again, not conclusive, but information pointing in that direction was unearthed by a diligent listener who found this particular information in the Stockton Record of October 7th of 1989. Going to read some sections of a Stockton Record article by Paul Feist, F-E-I-S-T, of the Record. It's had the State Line Sacramento and headlined, Purdy Report Fills in Details But Still Leaves Questions. Violent, desolate childhood fueled hatred of Asians. Oh, by the way, bear in mind, too, that the spokesperson for the Stockton School District, in which this event occurred, had been the chief spokesperson for the U.S. Army Western States Command until 1985. Again, that may be totally apocryphal, but I thought in light of the limiting of access to firearms and with some ominous indications of the involvement of the military and civilian law enforcement to combat the drug menace and what I viewed as a creeping martial law scenario, that is an interesting thing to keep in mind. Again, it may be apocryphal, but it may be significant. Again, going back to the Stockton Record of October 7th of 1989, this Paul Feist article has a number of interesting details about Patrick Edward Purdy. Predictably, perhaps, the commission that investigated this incident and specifically was looking for any connections between Patrick Purdy and hate groups found no connection. Again, I wonder where he got the Aryan Nations literature. It appears to have had an effect on his thinking. He had an Aryan Nations graffito on his rifle at the time he performed this crime. In this Paul Feist article, there's an interesting piece of information. Again, this is from a 1981 examination by a psychiatrist of Patrick Purdy, and it relies on information provided by Purdy himself. But here's an interesting detail, and something the press has not covered, something that has not received a lot of publicity. The he here is Purdy. He said he had panhandled for the Unification Church, run by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, but left after he realized he could keep only a small amount of the money he received. Well, in Radio Free America number 7, we specifically looked at the Unification Church as one of the main examples of a number of cults that appear to have been used by the National Security Establishment and the intelligence agencies, and beyond that, which appear to be outgrowths of the CIA and military's mind control programs. So it's interesting here to see that Patrick Purdy had worked for the Unification Church. Again, he was a panhandler. Doesn't say how long he worked for them or how old he was when he worked for them. But this is interesting here because the Unification Church is nothing if not an explicitly political organization, and it is explicitly fascist. Its roots go back to I guess you could call it Imperial Korea, to Korea when it was a Japanese colony, and when many of the key Korean military people who were to figure in the Unification Church were working for the Imperial Japanese military during World War II. Certainly its roots go back to Imperial and Fascist Japan. So it's interesting to see Edward Patrick Purdy, or Patrick Edward Purdy. I'll probably do that from now till God knows when. That's just one of those things. I think of Edward Patrick Purdy, but it's Patrick Edward Purdy. I'll think of Pep. That's the way to do it. I'll think of him as Pep. Pep's last stand here. Interesting, again, going into that same Paul Feist article to look at some of the descriptions of Patrick Purdy. Skipping down again in that same article, again, Stockton Record, October 7th of 89. In 1986, Purdy went to the Sacramento County Mental Health Center and complained of hearing voices. He cried and said his mother severely abused him as a child. Purdy said he was living in his car and was feeling lonely and unloved, unquote. Quote, "I'm not thinking the way I should be thinking," unquote, Purdy was quoted as saying. He said he sympathized with a postal worker who had shot several co-workers in Oklahoma. He said he was hearing voices telling him, quote, to do things, unquote. These sorts of things are dismissed as elements of schizophrenia, paranoia, hallucinations, and certainly people suffering from those types of psychopathology do hear voices. One of the problems is, though, that the CIA's mind control programs also led to people who experienced similar things as a result of those programs. So the fact that somebody's hearing voices telling him to do things doesn't automatically mean the guy's flipped his lid. It may mean that somebody has flipped it for him. One of the things that I brought out earlier in the year in connection with some of these schoolyard shootings is that many of these people do have some interesting connections. There was a schoolyard bombing in, I believe it was Nebraska or possibly Oklahoma, one of those two states, and or maybe it was Kansas, I've forgotten which, some of the Midwest, one of those states, and the people involved in that had connections to the Aryan Nations. There was a schoolyard shooting down in Southern California. The guy had connections to the People's Temple, which, as we've looked at, appears to have been an intelligence front. Again, Radio Free America shows 6 and 7. It's interesting here to see that Patrick Edward Purdy not only had come in contact at some point with the Aryan Nations, but that he apparently was working for the Unification Church, explicitly a mind control organization, and an organization which has achieved virtual dominance in the conservative wing of the Republican Party at this point. So again, this is possibly a very significant detail. It may be, if my hypothesis is correct, if it is correct, this may be where Patrick Purdy was gotten onto his mind control track, so to speak. This may have been where, I guess you could say, he left the road. This is where perhaps he was placed on the road to his last stand at the Cleveland Elementary School.
It's interesting, too, a couple of other pieces of information here. Again, the conclusion was that Patrick Purdy was a lone nut. Interesting, too, he had some of the inscriptions that he had, some of the graffiti that he had around his room and on his clothing. He had the symbol for the Zodiac Killer as well. May hypothesize that the Zodiac Killer was one of those California violence as a form of provocation. Gave bad publicity to the so-called counterculture, served to terrorize people. They never caught the Zodiac Killer. They did, however, catch a guy named David Toschi, or Toschi, T-O-S-C-H-I, who was the detective in charge with investigating the case, and they caught him writing Zodiac notes. They just said it was a product of professional stress. He'd been on the case too long. But it is interesting that in light of May's hypothesis that this was a provocation, albeit a very sophisticated one, we see the head of the chief detective in charge with catching the Zodiac Killer writing Zodiac notes to the police. Again, not conclusive, but awfully interesting and suggestive of May's hypothesis as being a correct one. Interesting that Purdy had Zodiac Killer insignia on him at the time, or in his room and on his person at the time he pulled off the Stockton schoolyard killings. Also, again, one of the points that I made about Edward Patrick Purdy at the time was that he appeared to do far too much traveling for someone on his very limited income. He had a disability check for something like 600 some odd a month, yet he traveled all over the country, and he did much more traveling than would appear to have been possible given his income. From another article about Purdy's background, this from the Stockton Record, again, October 7th of 89, by Sam Quinones of the Stockton Record, an article called Rare Study Conducted on Gunman's Motivations. A couple of details skipping down in the article. There were gaps. One of the people here is Stockton police, is someone named Yee. This is one of the California police officials involved with investigating Stockton's background. There were gaps throughout his whole life, Yee said. The agents traveled within Northern California, but relied on other agencies for information on Purdy's frequent nationwide wanderings. The agents estimated they used 42 different law enforcement departments across the country. Again, that is indicative of the way this guy got around. And again, it is not absolutely conclusive, but it's real fishy the way this guy was able to travel around, get busted, go in and out of jail with no apparent means of support. Now, given the fact that jail prisons are crowded, it's not surprising that he could get in and out of jail, but get an awful lot of traveling for someone with his limited means of support.
That again from Miscellaneous Archive Show M55, the program itself from 1992, but featuring two long tape excerpts from January and October of 1989, almost 30 years ago. Note Purdy's xenophobia about, quote, immigrants, unquote. Note his contact with the Aryan Nations and the Unification Church. And note the effect on parents and children of the school shootings and the de facto form of terrorism that they in fact represent. When you subject a society to this kind of thing, they are going to react, and they are going to want to be made secure. It is a very sophisticated form of terrorism, albeit one that is not being discussed in the way that I think it should be. And if you subject a population to this, much as the population of Weimar Germany was subjected to the Fritz Haarmann case, if you have a population in which the children can be dispatched with abandon by any one of a number of mass killers, whether a police informant like Fritz Haarmann or someone with an automatic rifle, this creates a fearful population and one that will more readily accept a dictatorship or creeping martial law. We will talk more about this in our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 1002, School Shootings and Fascist Groups, Part 1, Purdy's Last Stand Redux, being recorded on March 27th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.